La 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 la. Ooh la la la. Ooh la la la.
If you want to hear your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. They talk megabytes to petabytes and cover it all. They're the Gizmo.
Welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 110. Amazing, 110. We've done maybe, this might be the sixth episode we've recorded this year. Actually, it's about the 12th episode, but it would be maybe the sixth episode that we ever post. Just because I've gotten to be really picky when I listen to the first 5 minutes, if I'm not drawn in, I tend to, oh, you know, the next time we do this, it'll be that episode. So, I'm Chris, and I'm here with Matt today.
Hello.
We're on the downside of the 2016 presidential election.
Downside? I'm on the upside.
Well, it is the upside, but not for everybody. If you look at what's going on in the news, I'm puzzled because the system actually worked the way it was designed.
For once.
You know, the will of the people, actually, and don't argue with me over, well, popular vote. Both candidates got 47% of the vote. There's actually a plus or minus 5% error because they don't count the absentee ballots when there is a huge runaway with the Electoral College.
Plus, as I've heard, they haven't certified Michigan yet, and when they call Michigan for Trump, that will push him up. Over Hillary in the popular vote too.
Correct.
So
yeah. So, but you know, the whole idea is there was 8 cities who hold about more than half the U.S. population, and then the rest of the country. And
which is why the founding fathers
created the electoral system.
Anyway.
Yep. And. So regardless of what side you're on, you know, wanting the president to fail is like wishing your airline pilot when you're in the middle of the blue skies has a failure and, you know, we all crash and burn. That's probably the best meme I've seen regarding it. And I'm puzzled by a lot of it because you look at the Constitution and the way the founding fathers' intention of how a lot of this was to operate. I don't quite understand some comments that you see on the internet. I think it's blustering. Yeah, people are disappointed. Has this been a polarizing election? And you know, with people who were angry on both sides and everything else, I would say absolutely. If you saw 60 Minutes last Sunday, they had their pollster, who was a contributor to CNN. He did a poll, or CNN, to 60 Minutes, a guy who they've worked with for like the last 20 or 30 years, and he did a poll for them that they videoed, and he was beside himself. He said, I've never seen the amount of anger that exists, you know, in this election cycle.
Well, I want to go back to something you said about this election being polarizing. Yeah, that's what elections are. They're supposed to be polarizing. But I think the level of anger that really middle-class America in general, I mean, we can really tear into the demographics if you really want, but generically speaking, middle-class Americans had enough of political elites telling them what to do.
Yep.
And Donald Trump is many things, but a politician is not one of them.
Correct. Well,
whereas Hillary,
well, she's a
lifetime quintessential politician.
Absolutely.
I mean, when she first came onto the scene, I really kind of discounted her as being just Bill Clinton's wife. But she's learned some things.
Well, if you believe everything that's out there, the reality of it is everything Bill did is because of her. She's the man, or in her case, the woman behind the scenes.
Which brings me to Kellyanne Conway, or whatever her name is. I think it's interesting that there hasn't been near the credit given to her.
As being the first woman to run a successful presidential campaign and win?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I find that very telling.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing is, so, you know, you have James Carville of the CNN, Clinton News Network. You had an interview with him, and I'm watching it, you know, and I've always, of all of those people who actually worked on campaigns and then become kind of political commentators, after the fact, I've always considered him one who was kind of more in the middle than really in one side. And even on this one, he was speaking gibberish.
Well, I think that just goes to further show how out of touch the political consultant class
is with reality. I totally agree.
I mean, I watched Returns on Fox News and was taken aback by how shocked even the Fox News crew was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now I've been saying for years that Fox News stopped being the conservative news network a while back.
Yeah.
But I think your average American is going to still think of Fox News as being right-wing news, and it really isn't.
Well, it's writer-wing.
Yeah. I'll give you that. Anybody that's going to still employ Sean Hannity has got to be right or wing.
Yeah. You know, and I don't want to beat this to death because I think everybody's sick of political advertising and what's going on and all this. But I'll tell you, since I've been able to vote, because the year I turned 18 happened to be an election year. So that was when I turned 18, I got to vote that for the first time that year. My oldest daughter, this was her first time ever.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it was, but she's in her 20s.
Historic.
Yeah.
So that's, I was a freshman or sophomore in college, my first presidential. And, you know, the first one is always eye-opening. It really is.
Absolutely.
Either you voted the right way or you voted the wrong way and were awakened to the possibilities of how wrong you could be.
Yep.
Which is...
But one of the things that I think is great about this election is how... Going back to that thing about the media, you know, the media quit reporting news way back in the mid to late 90s, and then they started reporting what I call, they all became the Sun and the Star.
Infotainment.
Infotainment, because they wanted to maintain ratings. Part of that is because nobody will admit it, but there's really no need for more than two of these stupid news channels. You don't need an MSNBC and a CNN and a Fox and a this and a that. And you know, the internet definitely changed newspapers too, and they became infotainment because they were trying to stay
relevant
in the internet age. And I mean, one of the things that I despise today still is the whole paywall. And one of our local newspapers is my favorite, Dayton Daily News. When you log in, they put a cookie on your machine. You can only read three premium, what they call premium news stories, which could be local news, a month. And then they wonder why their subscribership is down and why nobody cares what they have to say when all the local television stations report the same news and it's free on their website.
Well, and not only that, but it's fresher.
Yeah.
Yeah. The newspapers in this country are still stuck in that model of we have one edition. That's when you get your news, whether it's
on the internet or in,
you know, and they fail to understand the marketplace of ideas has gone past that model.
Well, the other thing is the model, unfortunately, is changed to the point where five people can do the work that 105 people used to do, you know. And they're still in that model of, well, we need to maintain a print edition, so we have to have all this infrastructure. And when I say infrastructure, I even mean the people who maintain that print edition. And so they're trying to monetize it in a market where the profits are no longer either as big or in a market that you don't need, or there's way too much competition. Because we don't need 50 newspapers in the state anymore, you know. In reality, you could probably have two competing news websites that employed a couple hundred people apiece, because that way they'd have bureaus across the state to get news and remain cogent regionally. And that doesn't exist in the current model, because they're still holding on to this legacy system. And it'll eventually, not today, because it's certainly changed from 10 years ago when they were much more print-oriented, you know, and now they're getting more web-oriented. But eventually, you know, the print newspaper will go the way of the dodo, you know, and that will also be another death knell into what I call the public library system, which is a tax burden that, to a large part, has... is superfluous in today's world. I know people will argue with me, but the library was never intended to be an entertainment venue. And that's what libraries have become as well, as entertainment. And as more and more people get access to computers, even in the United States, where they're ubiquitous anyway, a lot of that data that they have can be online, and you already see it. You can check out ebooks at both Montgomery County, Warren County library systems and Hamilton County library systems in the state of Ohio. So why do we have buildings filled with, you know, with print copies? Now, personally, I still love to read a printed copy of a book. I still read them on my iPad and I read them on my phone. Because it's not always convenient to take, you know, a big old book with you. But there is something nice about being able to sit down with a book and, you know, it doesn't have a refresh rate so your eyes don't get tired and stuff like that from that. But to me, that's more of a nostalgic novelty than it is, could I live without it? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think that the audience that the public library serves isn't you and me. In all reality, it's so your suburban public library is a waste.
Yes.
But I think like downtown, you know, that serves a major metropolitan area, that's a different thing.
Well, and I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, the library system would go totally away, but the model needs to change, because you don't need a local library in every town, particularly affluent towns.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
You just need a regional library that you can access via the web, you know. And but, you know, libraries that exist for research where there's a lot of non-digitized data, you know, for genealogical research or that kind of thing, but even encyclopedias. And I don't go to the library anymore. I used to work at the library. I don't even go to the library anymore, so I don't even know if they're still making print versions of encyclopedias. encyclopedias as a research tool is kind of wasted because it's so narrow in scope and what it is, and it doesn't get up again. Going back to that whole updated, as information and research changes, they can't go back in and update it. So a lot of their, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica and Webster's and all those guys went digital many years ago because they could continually update their product, and they made it a subscription model. So say you need it for 3 months, but you don't need it 12 months of the year. They let you buy it for 3 months, you know. You know, and the fact that you can search for things as opposed to, you know, actually search using Boolean terms, so, you know, and or not, and get real specific on what you're looking at, whereas, you know, in encyclopedia, it's you spend far more time trying to find data than you do actually utilizing that data.
Although sometimes I wonder if because data is easier to access and locate, if that doesn't lead to bias errors in how data is used. You know, you'll find your little factoid, and then that's the end of your research.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really spend the kind of time you used to on research.
Well, I don't think it's that. I think it's validating your sources. Today, people don't validate sources. Like, there's a TV show I absolutely love. I don't agree with them every time I watch it, but I love the show, and that's Adam Ruins Everything. And one of the things I love about it is they provide all the sources for everything they do, all the attributions for, you know, where they got this fact and everything else, so you can determine. Wikipedia, strangely enough, to be an open source thing, is largely factual. If it's an article where they've gone through and they've cited all their sources and things like that, and that's the other thing, that, you know, Wikipedia in and of itself is a research tool, at least to get general information on things, has probably changed the library system in the United States greatly, because now you're getting correlation of sources. And, you know, and most of those sources now exist online, so now it's, oh, I want to check this source. What did the source really have to say, you know, to make sure that there's no... And you have people who are checking those sources as part of that. And, yes, can you go in there and you could change some facts, but eventually somebody's going to figure out... And usually that's over something stupid, like, you know, a bio of somebody. They'll go in and change it to...
But to your main point, that technology is really changing the business world.
Yeah.
And has been for quite some time. You know, there are certain industries that still are lagging behind. But I think even newspaper and really the media in general has really got a swift kick in the butt.
So, you know, I looked at, I mean, I've worked in this industry, and, you know, I hate to use this term because it's kind of a negative term, but we talk about disruptive technology. And you get people who aren't really savvy and they don't really understand what that means, you know, and they go, disruptive, you know, I don't want anything disruptive. I want it to be reliable.
That's not what it's about.
It's not what it's about. It's about technologies that come in and they replace other technologies, or they change, because of the nature of the technology and what it does, it changes the way we do things. And there's a lot of disruptive technologies that we don't even think about. Cell phones were one of them. When the smartphone came out, and all of a sudden you had the access to the World Wide Web in your pocket, and that was a disruptive technology. The cookbook industry is by far suffering the most from disruptive technologies, and nobody thinks about it. Because why do I need to buy a cookbook when I can go to Bing or Google and I can
get any recipe? Yeah.
And who are the ones who are taking advantage of it the most? Not the print industry, it's the media industry, so Food Network and AllRecipes.com and these guys who realize that, you know, if we maintain a searchable trove of recipes, we could sell advertising to them, and that's how we monetize it.
I can't remember the last time I looked at a cookbook.
I didn't.
My wife does not cook. I think she can do it. She did graduate from college, top of her class, but she's afraid to boil water. And so,
really?
Yeah. If it cannot be made in the microwave.
Really?
Yeah.
That shocks me. I'm shocked.
Now, she can bake, but she won't.
Well, yeah.
She won't cook.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm with you.
And so my son loves pork chops, and he was like, I want pork chops for dinner. So I was like, I don't want to fry pork chops. At this, it's a big mess and all this stuff. And the pork chops I have are bone-in as opposed to the boneless tenderloin, which is the kind that's better to fry because then you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
And so I was like, well, I wonder if they're, you know, a baked pork chop recipe. I mean, when we got married, like everybody, she got a set of cookbooks and stuff. And then I didn't go look for those cookbooks and see what I had in a cookbook. I went online and it said baked pork chops, you know.
And there you go.
And then I could go through the recipes and go, oh, I like this one. I don't like this one. And, you know, that's a lot of times, like, my mom's an old country cook, and so a lot of the cooking I know how to do is old country type cooking. And so there are certain things that I'm not good at because I just don't do it very often. But, like, I made pork tenderloin in the crock pot the other day, which, by the way, if you don't cook with a crock pot, you're an idiot. It's, like, the easiest.
The best thing ever.
No, you could hardly screw anything up. And so I cooked pork tenderloin, you know, and so then I had the juice. I'm like, well, we need some gravy for the mashed potatoes that goes with this and for the pork tenderloin. And I'm like, okay, so how do I make gravy? I know that I can thicken gravy up with flour or cornstarch. And so, you know, again, went online. Okay, how much cornstarch should I use?
How much of this do I need for this?
But going back to my wife not cooking, so her family growing up, her dad did not let you waste food. So if she's afraid if she screws it up, you know, she wasted a whole bunch of food. And I'm not that way. If I screw it up, I just throw it away.
I don't remember who it was. One of the big chefs of the 20th century said that the least expensive thing in the kitchen is the food you're making. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you screw it up, go out and start over.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, well, that's a very American approach to things, but
yeah, well, it is what it is. The other issue is this, is, you know, you're not going to learn how to do it, much less learn what you like, unless you play around with it.
Exactly.
Like, my mom, she might make something, if she makes something from a recipe that she didn't create, she will make it just like the recipe says once.
Me too.
And then never again. And I'm the same way. You know, I like, no, I want more pepper. We have food allergies in my family, so we can't use certain ingredients. Like garlic is a good one.
Really?
Yeah. And so because we don't use garlic, we tend to flavor things differently because, like, we can eat peppers. So we use a lot of paprika and we use chipotle pepper powder and, you know, to kind of give something a little bit of flavor, you know. We probably use a lot more cumin than most people do. You know, to add heat to it, because a lot of people add heat by adding more garlic, which that's an argument that I don't get, because garlic was originally used in food to cover the taste of spoiled food.
Right.
Not because it was actually good for you or anything else. But, you know, that's kind of a disruptive technology when you talk about stuff that people do on an everyday basis today. And hardly anybody thinks about it.
So really, what I keep waiting to see in the kitchen of the future is appliances that have web access. And
they're there today. They're just, right now, they're the premium ones. ones.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Once that becomes mainstream, that will be extremely disruptive.
Yes.
Even more so than it is now.
Well, and the question is whether or not, because I mean the technology is there even for a lower level. The question then becomes, is that the best way to have that in your technology? You know, to have your stove have a touchscreen web browser access, or your today a lot of the where that's really built in is refrigerators, because they have places. Now I do think it's neat the refrigerators that have the television display built into it. That makes sense to me. You want, but even more so, I think about the ubiquitous, ubiquity of tablet computing, which, by the way, is not replacing laptops, which didn't replace desktops completely. Yes, did they shift the market, and are there fewer? There's still going to be needs for those, because they're more general purpose computing devices that people have to use. But as we get to, you know, tablets are cheap. So do we have tablets now that and we're starting to get to the point where the technology is becoming ruggedized or more waterproof and drop resistant and things like that. So given another 5 years down the road and, you know, everybody has a tablet in their kitchen that's either mounted on the wall or whatever, that they can then, you know, get their recipes and everything. I mean, you go in my kitchen and there's always an iPad laying around, or somebody's on their phone looking up.
I just anticipate at some point, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Tony Stark's Jarvis bit with the glass? Is that not a technology
that's a technology that's here today. You have competing ones. So you have I forget what Google's is called, but you have Google, you have Siri from Apple, you have Alexa from Amazon. You know, all of that exists today. Now, what I actually think is probably a more realistic disruptive technology compared to them building it into appliances is that every window and every mirror in a house could potentially be a display.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the more pervasive...
You know, and so instead of carrying your tablet around, they're all connected to a central computer in your house, or a central cluster of computers that would also include your tablets and your phones and your laptops. And you could just say, you know, Siri, put this up on the mirror in the kitchen, or the picture in the kitchen. And, you know, instead of it showing a picture of, you know, this landscape, it now becomes, it's showing your television show, or it's showing you a recipe it searched for and found on the internet. Or I think, and the technology is there to do that today. So I think it's just a matter of time before somebody goes through and they start selling it that way. Same thing with tables, like your coffee table. Microsoft tried to do it with the Surface table, which was the precursor to the Surface tablets and the Surface books. And it was really neat. It was just way too expensive at the time. So it was like, and at the time, touchscreen LCDs didn't, when they first did it, those things were so expensive that they actually created another technology to be able to recognize your finger touches on top of it using webcams. But you were still talking about a $30,000 or $40,000 table, whereas, you know, and they were marketing that to businesses, which made sense at the time. But you know, I can see it happening in your home. You know, get it down to where it's a couple $100 or even $500. If you get something within $500. You start seeing it become pervasive across, you know, homes and stuff. But you would start seeing it more often, even if you could get it in the 1,000 to 1,500. You know, as long as the features and technology were there. But...
Well, and it has to be consistent.
Yes.
It has to work consistently, and that's... Touchscreen technology is still, I think, not quite as good as it should be.
Yeah, there needs to be an increase in the fidelity. I think that's what stops many major computer manufacturers from going touchscreen only. You know, because the keyboards just don't quite work as well as a physical keyboard.
But I do see a shift in that direction.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Plus, and I think the as there are become more and more advances in voice recognition software, I think we'll eventually do away with the keyboard entirely.
I don't think we'll do away with it entirely. I just think what it'll be is the keyboard will be an alternate input for when you need to do things.
Yeah, but I'm saying your average user
will
be too lazy to use it.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yeah.
I mean, that's. I mean, like you, I don't think it'll ever totally go away.
Yeah.
I just think it'll be less likely to be the primary input.
You know, I'll give you another disruptive technology that people are having a complete, total, and overreaction to. So. And I'm recording this on an actual 2016 MacBook. It has only one port on it. Well, besides the headphone jack. It has one port, and it's a USB-C port. And Apple just redid their MacBook Pros, which have all this amazing new technology that nobody's reporting on underneath, because everybody is upset that they switched all the ports on it to USB-C ports, which are a beautiful technology. Doesn't matter which way you plug the cable in, it just the cable goes in and it works. But it's also Thunderbolt 3, which is a direct PCI connection, is also uses the same USB-C type connector. So Apple's the first to market with this, primarily as a major vendor of computing devices. Google on the Google Pixel Chromebook and on their latest flagship Nexus phone also have USB-C. It's the wave of the future. It's what's coming. But all these people are complaining, and this is what I find funny, is they're complaining that the new MacBook Pro is not designed for professionals. And I'm like, how can you say that? Just because they swapped the connector to the more future-proof one, and you want to use your legacy hardware, so you have to get an adapter to adapt it from... It didn't, like, go... They didn't go, well, all your legacy hardware, none of it's going to work, so you got to buy all new stuff. They could have done that. But they're switching to the next newest technology, and people are having a cowardice. Now, on the flip side, it's really just like the election. It's a minority of people making a big deal about this, because they've actually sold more of the new MacBook Pros, and they haven't even been out a complete month, than they sold laptops last year. You know, so you know the technology's there, and people are embracing it. Now, is it a pain in the ass right now? Yeah. I mean, I've lived with it. This is the second generation MacBook with USB-C that I had, because I had the previous model too, which my youngest daughter has. And, you know, I want to hook it to a VGA projector to do a presentation. Yeah, I have a dongle that has the VGA connection on it that goes to USB-C. Is it a pain in my butt? A little bit. Do I have to carry an extra dongle that weighs less than an ounce? Yes. But is it so disruptive that I can't get my work done, or it's caused me to be less productive? No, not at all. And you know, as we go forward in the future and you begin to lose these USB 2.0, and that's what's going to happen. So you'll have the USB 3 or USB-C connected devices that use a standard USB-C cable, and then those will be what becomes ubiquitous, and then you have to buy, you know, if you want to use an old USB connector, you have to then buy the adapter to do it the other way. And so what do people do? As well, they go, well, that's an old one, so I'll just buy a new whatever to connect to it. And, you know, and in reality, very rarely do I even use the USB port on any computer anymore. I do connect external hard drives occasionally, but... Even the one thing the flash drive industry has gotten real good at is they see a new connector type, and you get a new flash drive with that connector. And I've got a great one that has regular USB on one side and has USB-C on the other, so I can use it in all that stuff.
Way, yeah.
And that stuff, because it's so commodity and, you know, things cost $5 to $15, they're the first part of the industry that moves to that. But printing, how many, when was the last time you bought even a printer from Walmart and it didn't have the wireless capability to print wirelessly? And I don't personally print anything, even for work. It's the kids occasionally need to print something for school, and even that's becoming more and more rare. You know, because connectivity to computer systems have become more and more wireless. Now, if you were still on the legacy end of things, when I say that, you know, I know everybody doesn't upgrade their technology every year like I do. You know, where you have something that still has the older connection, and I do. My Surface Book, or not Surface Book, but my Surface Pro 3, which is the only Windows machine I own. I can't really say that. I do have a couple of other Windows tablets, but it has USB 3, but it's the old USB connector, not the new. You know. But even with it, I don't connect it to a whole lot of things where that's a necessary requirement. I mean, you know, it used to be we used to burn CDs and DVDs and we'd give people data that way. If I burn a CD, it is a rare occasion. I have spindles of blank CD-ROMs and DVD-ROMs at home.
Me too.
And I have to go search for where I put them because, you know, when I need to use one.
I've forgotten where I put them.
Because I have used it so rarely, I've forgotten where I
put it. Put it away in storage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
You know. And used to have boxes of software, too. You know, all my current software I used to have lined on a bookshelf. So when I had to have the disk for something or another, that's not the way software is delivered today. Music is no longer delivered. I mean, you can buy it on not CD, but why? Because usually if you buy it on CD, you better like every one of the songs. You know, I don't even buy music anymore. I have an Apple Music account, so new CD comes out, I download it. People talk about that they want to own stuff, but stuff like that, to me, on the subscription model, makes a lot more sense. Because I have access to all the new. I have access to a back catalog of stuff that I don't have to keep. But if I, you know, on a whim, I want to hear it one day. I can either stream it or I can download it and listen to it offline.
I don't know. I guess I'm still very much a child of the 80s. I want to own my stuff. I admit that's very very luddite of me. I'm not a, which is not to say that I haven't bought digital music.
Yeah.
I have, but it's
well,
still,
you know,
not my
it used to be
preferred method.
It used to be so here's another, so streaming video, mm-hmm. which is a subscription model type solution. So it used to be, Amazon Prime, I would get on, I would find out when the new DVDs for whatever I wanted came out, and I would just pre-order it. So that the day it came out, it would be delivered to the house, lowest price available, whatever. I don't even do that anymore. Like, you would think I'd own a great copy of Star Trek Beyond with the 4K digital and all this other stuff, and I'm like, I can stream it for free, or stream it for, and watch it whenever I want. Why do I want that disc and that thing hanging out at my house?
Now, I hadn't bought a DVD
in
forever, but I did go out and buy a DVD.
Yeah.
I think there are certain things that you just feel like I'm a big Trek fan,
yeah.
So I'm going to go get it, but...
Well, I actually purchased the digital version in that case,
yeah.
but so I do own it, but I don't have a physical disc, which I love, because I don't like, that's, as I've gotten older, and you know, I'm a collector, so I have a lot of stuff. I feel the need to get rid of more stuff, or at least store a lot more stuff, so it's not out, so that clutter goes away. Now, Molly is the exact opposite, and you know, she wants to have bookshelves full of her DVD and Blu-ray collection and all this stuff, and it's not to say we don't buy them, but it's more often that it's an older movie and it's not available on one of the streaming services. So, like, oddly enough, my oldest daughter, for one of her classes, they were going to give extra credit if you watched Nacho Libre, which is a horrible, horrible movie. And it wasn't available on any of the streaming services, so she texted me and says, hey, can you get a copy of this and so I can watch it for this class and get extra credit? And so couldn't find it anywhere. No, I mean, it wasn't available for purchase digitally or anything. So I'm at Walmart, we were there shopping and when she texted. So I go back in the movie section and I'm like,
it's got to be in the bargain bin.
I'm thinking, I couldn't find it in the bargain bin.
Really?
So I go back and I'm looking through and there is a Jack Black 3-pack that had School of Rock, Orange County, which is a phenomenal movie, and Nacho Libre together for, I think, $5. So I'm like, okay, I'll buy that. So I did buy that and sent her the Nacho Libre disc so that she could watch it for her class. But, you know, it's like, but, you know, at $5, if I decided I didn't want that anymore, I would have no compulsion to go.
Using it as a coaster? Yeah. Or, yeah. No, that's the other thing that I think is brilliant as some of these older technologies become less and less prevalent.
Yeah.
The cost has been driven down to such a point where...
Well, you know...
Those of us who are collectors of stuff like that...
When Blu-ray came out, you know, DVD players got cheap. You could go to Walmart and buy a DVD player for like $10, I think was the lowest I ever saw. And now you can't go to Walmart and buy a DVD player. Now you can go to Walmart and buy a Blu-ray player for about $20, you know. And do I think that technology will completely go away? No. I mean, there's corner cases where people have them. I mean, I know people who, like, we had a Blu-ray player in our RV, and part of that reason we had it is because, you know, you go to a campsite, but campsites now have such good Wi-Fi, you know, I'd rather have a Roku box that weighs, you know, it's almost nothing in size, or, you know, even the Roku stick stuck in the back of your TV, and those cost $30 now.
So the last DVD player I bought was actually a recorder that had a VHS deck in it, too.
So you convert
your... So I could
get
all my old stuff into a much more digital-friendly... Thank you. And I still don't use it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's...
Well, at home, we stream so much. I mean, and, you know, cable TV is kind of an anachronism. And it's become so much of an anachronism. I mean, it's kind of funny. My wife is getting there, but I'm very much like my kids because I travel a lot for work. My iPad becomes my TV wherever I go. I never turn the TV on in a hotel room, ever. I haven't probably for the last 2 or 3 years for any reason because I have no desire to watch the news networks or ESPN. I you know, if I'm working and I want to watch TV in my hotel room or I want to watch TV, I pull my iPad out and I hit Netflix or whatever and I watch it. And at home I do the same thing. I mean, my kids will watch entire TV shows on their phones, but or on their laptop. My youngest daughter 2 years ago said, Dad, I don't need a TV in my room anymore. And she unplugged everything and set it outside her door for me to get. You know? And so her TV is now in the basement, you know, so that there's something down there. And we're lucky to live in an area where we can get, or at least where I live, I can get about 60 stations because I can get all the way to Lexington, Kentucky and Indianapolis, Indiana, and then Dayton and Cincinnati. And that's over the air. So why do I have cable anymore? You know, and why do I watch commercials when I don't have to? I always thought the VAT tax in Great Britain, or the TV tax in Great Britain, you know, that they paid it, and that tax directly pays for everything that the BBC channels do. I always thought that was great because, for the most part, BBC doesn't have any advertising. They advertise their new shows, but they don't advertise, you know. And I always thought that was a great idea. Why can't we pay a TV tax and then not have to pay to, or not have to watch advertising?
Well, we kind of do. That's NPR and public television.
Yes.
I mean, really?
Yeah. But the funniest thing is, so I'm in Costco, and this was actually a couple months ago, and I don't have a 4K TV. I don't really see the need for a 4K TV because I can already see people's pores on a 1080p HD TV.
And that's crazy enough.
Yeah. I don't want to see the oil in those pores, you know. And 4K just, to me, is an entertainment. I mean, because my laptop screen is 4K on my laptop and my desktop. The screens are greater than 1080p. They're like 2.5K on your tablets today. So you're getting to see that stuff without having to buy, you know, a $4,000 TV. But even 4K TVs keep dropping in price because that's a commodity item. But I'm walking through and just looking at them because the thing about the 4K TVs is not so much that they're 4K to me. It's you can now get, like, a 70-inch TV.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at it, and I'm like, you know, when you sit 10 feet away from that, that's like having a 40-foot TV. You know, the like going to the movie theater type experience, but at home. And I'm looking at them. None of them have tuners in them anymore. They just have a DV or HDMI inputs, which is something I've said for a long time. If you have to have a cable box to get cable, why does a TV have a tuner? And the fact that you can buy digital tuners that are external boxes today anyway, why isn't that the mode that you're buying it? You know, same thing with, you know, these guys who are, for a long time, that, you know, the thing was is to make my TV better, let's put Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and all these things in them. They never ran great, and they were hard to update. Why not just, you know, make a TV with 8 HDMI ports so that I can hook my Roku and my Apple TV and my Amazon Fire and all these little boxes that hardly cost anything up to it and let that be the input and it just be a display?
Yeah.
Which goes back to my point of where I think we're getting to the point where, because they're just displays,
yeah,
now it's, you know, they... Let's make it look more like, you know, let's wrap it in a picture frame because now I don't need to have.
Don't need all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, as the flat panels become more displays than TVs, that makes much more sense.
Yeah. And one of the things that has been great is I'm a huge fan of Instructables, you know, which is a. People share their DIY, you know, hacking thing or ideas and how they've implemented them out there. And so you get to see how they do it. And they give you the better part is they, to me, is not how they do it. I know how to do a lot of this stuff. It's the parts list. You know, what parts did you use? So I don't have to go research, oh, I need, you know, this many resistors of this kind and all this other stuff. And, the big thing is to take a cheap, like, Android tablet and put it, mount it in such a way in your bathroom, behind the mirror, so that when it's on, you can see, use it as a display, and when it's not, all you see is your reflection in the mirror. And that's, that. I think that's where a lot of this is going to go. The other thing is, I don't think there's as big a demand for these huge monitor or huge televisions anymore in people's houses. One, at some of these are getting to the point, you know, I think the biggest one I've seen is like an 84-inch. where are you going to hang that? Because
there are people who are designing homes
around their TV. I know.
That have a home theater room in it. And they're literally now home theaters. I mean, they're not just like a...
Oh, yeah, and they put...
Living room.
They put theater seats and everything else.
That's crazy.
Oh, I know. But that's been going on for a while.
Well, yeah.
Because it started off with the digital projector revolution. Right. You know, as they came down in price, hey, we can afford to put one of these in our house and put a screen and, you know. But, you know, an 84-inch display. And you know, that kind of goes back to my... We don't need to be building a whole lot of new houses. We need to be either refurbishing old ones or tearing things down and then rebuilding on that existing land. Because, I mean, in the United States, if you look at how much housing is for sale at any given time, or how much housing is not only for sale but vacant at any given time, you really wonder why we continue to build new stuff.
Well, I think part of that...
There's a whole bunch of... socioeconomic, political issues why that's happening, but you know, and also we're Merca.
I was just gonna say that we have become such a nation of users to the point where it's, you know, it's got to be new, it's got to be fresh. The renovating the old is no longer the American way.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're exactly right. You know, and that's why you end up having these subdivisions. You know, so you have older subdivisions that were the in place to live in this decade, and then 10 years or even 15 years or 20 years later, when you can no longer build new houses in that subdivision. So now everybody in that subdivision goes, you know, I want a new house, so we're going to go over to this new subdivision that's just being developed. And everybody moves out, and so all of a sudden you have this vacant, and you know, the homes, what I think a lot of it is people don't, homes have become, as expensive as they are in the United States, homes have become disposable commodities. Oh, it's old. Yada, yada, yada. People don't update their homes anymore. You know, it used to be people would update the kitchens and they'd update the bathrooms. And, you know, so a home would last for a long, long, long time. You know, at least multiple generations of people living in them to the point where something would... You know, something would happen to him, like, you know, the foundation cracks. And then they would tear it down.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do that anymore.
I've seen, well, I'm not so sure about that.
We do to some degree.
The big house flipping industry is doing a lot of that, where they'll go in there and they'll literally gut a whole house down to the bare bones and rebuild it, which is crazy to me, because at that point it's... Might as well just knock the whole thing down.
Kelton, can you come
to
the cafe counter, please?
Yes, there is a house flipping industry where they do some of that stuff. My personal opinion and the limited amount of research I've done on it, it's not nearly as big as television would like us to think it is.
Yeah. Right.
You know. So, one last thing I want to discuss, and we're going to go. We're going to circle this back around to the beginning.
Okay.
Is one of the things that I find totally hilarious that was on the ballot in Washington, D.C. during this presidential election was a referendum to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state.
Really? We're still on that?
And voters overwhelmingly in that, you know, in the District of Columbia, overwhelmingly approved. And I'm sitting here going, so one, it should not be a state.
I have thought for years the best resolution to that is for Congress to pass a law saying there shall be no residential construction in the district.
Yes.
get all those people out of there, and then they can be represented. That district was never set up to house people.
No, it was designed
to house. It designed and housed the federal bureaucracy.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yep. Well, the problem is so when it was originally set up, even trains were a rarity. So people had to live close. They had to live within 25 miles at least, because it would at 25 miles would be about what you could travel in a day with a horse. So, that's what really started. But the thing is, you know, we talk about Washington D.C. and physically, it's not a very large area overall, but the whole suburban area around it is massive. My personal opinion is I don't know why we have the capital of our country still in on a coast when it would be better served to be in the middle of a country. You know, stick in the middle of Oklahoma or Montana.
No, see, and you the can't, other, you other can't thing do is, that because that's the middle of flyover country, and then these people would have to actually learn something about the people. That's never going to happen.
Yeah. Well, my favorite question, having worked for the federal government as a consultant for years, is everybody asking me if I'm in the Eastern time zone and I live in Ohio. And I mean, not just once. The same people would ask over and over again because they didn't believe that I didn't live in the Central or Mountain time zone. You know, there is a huge disconnect between the coasts and the majority of the country.
Well, yeah.
But the other thing is, I don't know that we need a centralized bureaucracy.
We don't.
You know, it really, frankly, should be spread out. That way, particularly today, with the information highway and networking and teleconferencing and, you know, why it all exists together like that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
It keeps people having jobs.
That wouldn't change. It just would spread the wealth out a lot more. Because, I mean, D.C. has some other issues going on for it. It is a housing bubble ready to burst. It's also encouraging part of the reason politicians and I would say even what I would call the people who live in D.C. and Northern Virginia and Maryland around that area, you know, the national capital region, as they like to call themselves, part of the reason they're so disconnected from the reality of the rest of the country is because they live in an area where they don't see any difference. And, you know, housing costs is a good example. I mean, if you live within the Beltway, a 1,100 square foot home could cost you millions of dollars. And it would be a shack where I live. I mean, literally a shack. Because it wouldn't have been updated in 80 years and, you know, may not have ever had insulation. And even in the Northern Virginia area, you know, $1.5 million home there would only be a $200,000 or $250,000 home in most of the United States.
Yep,
and so that encourages, because there's a limited number of people who can afford a home that like that at that cost. All of a sudden, you get this what I call a staleness of thought, or a stagnation of society there, because they don't realize, because you're not getting new ideas, you're not getting people moving in, you know, and the people who move in are living in apartments that your monthly rent is what most of us pay as a house payment, if not greater than our house payment.
what's worse is so much of the bureaucracy is just not needed, for one.
Yeah.
But definitely not needed in D.C.
Oh, absolutely. But, and there are a lot of agencies that need to go away, at least the federal versions of them. EPA is a good one.
There's no
reason for that. It's a huge bureaucracy that doesn't do anything except essentially collect another set of taxes from business. Federal Highway, I'm not quite sure why we need a whole organization for the Federal Highway when in reality it's the states that take federal funds and build and maintain all those highways. You know?
Well, somebody's got to manage the federal funds. You see?
Yeah, that's called Congress. How about GAO, OMB?
You will get no argument from me. But that's the reason. I mean, the Department of Transportation is mostly useless.
There are functions in there, small functions. You know, like the guys who, I forget, the Federal Highway Safety, Traffic and Safety Administration. They have some functions that are, you know, they determine whether or not cars actually meet the safety requirements to come and, you know, be on our roads in the United States. They manage the testing for recalls.
You're talking NTSB.
Or NTSB, National, yeah.
Yeah, somebody's got to go out there and investigate the plane crashes.
Exactly. But,
and I get that.
I get that. But, you know, the larger group. Actually, I don't see a real reason for having the Federal Department of Education.
Well, that's the
every
first law
every state list. Has their own Department of Education. And
they keep talking about national standards, but the problem with national standards has always been who sets the standard and why are we teaching to a test?
Exactly.
Because that's ultimately what that becomes. When you set a standard, when you set that bar, that becomes what...
Yeah, nobody exceeds standards in that case.
No, because that's what government does. They just meet the standard, and then we're done.
Well, if you meet the standard, we'll give you an A+, and then you get your funding.
Right. And that's then it just becomes about funding and not about the education.
Exactly.
And that's the problem that I think we have with education. It's become about the almighty dollar and not about almighty knowledge.
Yep. Yep.
And that's pervasive at all levels of education.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you know, so we have this huge government in a relatively small space. You know, so one of the TV shows I like to watch, and I don't know why I like to watch it, because in some respects it's like watching political election stuff, but the new show with Kiefer Sutherland, Designated Survivor.
I've watched a couple episodes of it, and I need to get caught back up, because it is really good.
It is, you know, and you got the guy, he's the director of HUD.
Yeah.
Housing and Urban Development, and
he had gotten fired the morning of.
And he's the designated survivor who becomes president. But I mean, that in reality, that is a reality, because and it can be much worse than that, because you have all these headquarters organizations and everything that all exist in one area. So, you know, if you could create a natural disaster or a terrorist attack large enough, you could disable a lot. You know,
I just think that we take an awful risk. I mean, it would cost a large fortune to spread our government back out, but I think the advantages of it are huge.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And some of it would be easy, because other than the Pentagon, really, Department of Defense is distributed.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, and there are some things like Bureau of Land Management is headquartered in Columbus, Ohio. So it's not in D.C. But it makes much more sense to have satellite offices for them in, you know, wherever you would put the legislative and executive place of government, but even the Supreme Court does not have to be.
There's no reason why we need that concentrated, you know, that much levels of concentrated power in one geographic location.
Yeah.
It defies all logic and really plays into our enemy's hands. More so now than probably ever before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and yes, can we, you know, touch anybody pretty much anywhere in the world, and many of our enemies can too. So, you know, that's always the argument. Well, you know, if we move it in the middle of the country, what would that gain us? Well, they would still have to fly over most of the country to get there, so there'd be a lot better chance to counteract, or, you know, counterattack the, and deploy countermeasures to stop it, as opposed to, hey, we're right there on the coast, and, you know, all I have to do is pull up a missile destroyer, you know, 3 miles off the coast, because I'm in international waters, and
it's not like that's not been dreamed up before.
No, if we're thinking about it.
Tom Clancy's done it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, how many of these political intrigue designated survivors done?
Yeah. Well, think about World War II. And after the Allies won and they got a hold of a whole bunch of German intelligence, they figured out that the Germans had U-boats off the city of New York and off Washington, D.C. and all these places. And we were fat, dumb, and happy.
And that's not counting what Hydra did.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Red Skull.
Thank you.
So I think we're going to end it there. I thought today was pretty good talk.
Pretty good conversation.
Yeah. So we want to hear from you, our listeners. So please send any feedback, audio, video, text to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Or hit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.